This is Dave Crippen at the archives for the Center of the Study of the History of Automotive and Industrial Design at the Henry Ford Museum. This is 6/22/84, and today we're talking with Alan Ornes, who is a young up and coming designer at and stylist at Ford, having worked with the Mustang, the Mark 7, and the Cougar programs. And we are going to ask Mr. Ornes to recount his career in Ford and Ford Styling and elsewhere. So we'll turn it over to you, Mr. Ornes.
Okay, well, since I can remember, you know, back in my childhood, I've always been interested in automobiles, and you know, my parents even tell, you know, before I remember things, of all the interest I showed, even, you know, riding in them or being around automobiles. So this isn't something that came to me late in life, but you know, I always drew cars in my classes at school, and all my test sheets that were turned in usually have more drawings on them than they had answers. But that was been a passion throughout my life. So then, as I got into high school, I decided that this Fisher Body Guild, I think it was, they had a contest or something at the time, and so you build models, and I did that, and I don't know, I ended up getting some kind of a state award, I think, at the time. This was in 1958, and that sort of encouraged me, and then I wrote to the various automobile companies and asked, you know, how would they recommend that I get into the automobile design end of it, and they recommended various colleges, and one of them was Art Center College, Art Center School, they called it at that time. And of course, that sounded great to me. It was in California, and it was warm, and that's where all the neat cars were, and so that was where I applied. So after attending Art Center for 4 years, I graduated and was hired by Damon Woods, and I think maybe I can't remember who came with him at the time. Must have been Corrigan or maybe Tom Burns. And anyway, I started in at Ford Design Center then in 1963, I think June of that year.
Al, could you tell us a bit about the Art Center College of Design? Was that is that a seminal institution for automotive designers?
Well, it's been certainly one of the more one of the better providers of designers, I guess you'd say. I don't know what percentage in Detroit, but certainly in the world, it must be 60% of the designers working anywhere probably come from Art Center. But the main thing, they have a good reputation, therefore they attract quite a number of good students. They have a fairly rigid entrance so that they do get that level. And they have excellent instructors. They have people who have worked in the business, people I remember in my time there, Strother McMinn, you know, he worked with Frank Hershey, he worked at Murphy Body in Pasadena, I mean, he worked at GM, I mean, the man's just tremendous knowledge of automobiles and, of course, enthusiasm for design, and some of that rubs off on the students, naturally. And there was Dick Collier, I think, at that time, and it's, you know, a very exciting environment for someone wanting to get into the industrial design field, and automobiles particularly, but they do provide design education for a pretty broad range of fields, whether it's environmental design or product or film, fashion. I mean, there's quite a broad range of courses.
Do they also help you find jobs in the industry as well?
Well, to the extent that they have very strong contacts with, for instance, Ford or GM, and usually the case will be that executives will come from the various companies and interview at a certain day, and you show them portfolios. And so in that sense, the opportunities are provided, and assuming they have positions available and your work is up to their standards, why, yeah, they help very much.
So representatives of design?
Yes, that's how I was hired. Yeah, they representatives from Ford came out and, you know, made me an offer. It helps the student certainly you don't have to go back and pound on doors to any great extent, although that varies, I think, from time to time and economic conditions and all that. But at that time, in 1963, Ford hired, seems like, five or six of us all at one time. I mean, it was really a big, they were building up staff quite heavily through the early 60s. And so.
Anyone we know?
Well, let's see. Walt Goetzer came, I think, about, he might have been here a few months before me. I think he came the semester before. Tom Land, he graduated maybe a year before. A lot of the guys that I graduated with have gone on to other endeavors. Moved back to California or whatever. Let's see, Todd Smith and several guys that stayed for a few years and decided they wanted to do other things. There used to be a lot more turnover, I think, at Ford Design in that sense. You know, a lot of people would come and they'd work for a year, 2 years, and decide, well, they'd really rather live in California and do product or whatever. At that time, there weren't any automobile studios in California, so you didn't have that option.
Now everybody's out there.
Now, yeah, now it's more people than we have here, it seems.
So Ford liked your drawings and hired you?
Yeah, they thought they'd give me a chance, and so I was placed in interior studio and working with Ken Nelson, and of course Damon Wood was the director, and I can't remember who the exec might have been at that time. It might have been Gil Spear or Gail Halderman. I can't really remember the various times when those people were the execs of the studio. But we worked on the 66 Lincoln interior, and I can remember Ken Nelson. Really, he was a senior designer, I think, in the studio at the time. And Jim Powers, I believe, was my manager, but who quit one day. Very interestingly, he went out for lunch like normal and came after lunchtime. He just came in and picked up a little package off his desk, and that was the last we saw of him. He just walked out. That was I thought that was very dramatic. He, of course, I saw him, you know, other times at social occasion or something, but... we thought that was a very clean and clear way of just vanishing. But he took on other projects and I guess works in California now with his own office. But anyway, we were working on the 66 Lincoln interior, and that was one, as I remember, it had a very clean instrument panel. It had kind of a platform, if you will, or almost like a keyboard. And we had a radio on one side, and we tried very hard to balance on the left side then the heater controls so that, you know, visually everything was perfectly symmetrical. And I can remember all the problems. And Ken was very much involved in trying to get an electroluminescent system working, which is what Sylvania and various people have worked out for aircraft, where you have actually a matrix that flows a certain amount of current, and it will then with little masks, while you can have lettering or whatever, and it'll just light those areas. And it gives you a very even lighted appearance. We weren't able to get it on the vehicle, but we did learn certain things from it at that time. Now we're getting closer to using that sort of thing. We use it for ornamental lighting on the exterior even. And it was an interesting initiation, I guess, for a young designer, because, you know, in school, where you have certain projects and you carry it all the way from sketches and you make final presentations and all that. And of course, any models that you want, well, you build yourself and everything. Of course, here in the studio environment, well, you would do your own sketches, and if they were approved or selected, well, then you would move on to maybe what we'd call a shop drawing, but it was basically a simple engineering drawing that could be used as a fabrication drawing. And we had I remember having steering wheels made and various ornamental pieces, control buttons and things, and, you know, fascinated by the high quality and the ability to just, you know, get things really perfect. And so there was a very high level of professionalism in the studio at the time.
How did the 66 Lincoln turn out? Was it pretty good?
Yes, as I remember, even now, I think the instrument panel would be considered a handsome and certainly a luxurious interior. Very clean, simple, elegant, you know, the kinds of images we always try to achieve when we're working on a Lincoln or a Mark type vehicle. And part of it's from the fact you can use the top quality materials, and therefore you can be a little more simple in your graphic approaches. From then, at that time, when you were first brought into the company, well, you would stay about 6 months in each studio, and they'd rotate you through. That was one of the reasons I actually wanted to come to Ford. The other reason at the time in 1963 why the news was that Ford was going to buy Ferrari and we were going to go racing, and I could envision myself moving to Italy and, you know, driving Ferraris and the whole thing. You know, it was very dream world, but that was the nature in the 60s why the companies were into racing very heavily, and as we later did build our own race cars and won at Le Mans and everything, which I'll get into a little later. So then I moved on to Mercury Exterior, and there we worked on taillights and various things for the 66 Mercury. In 65, they'd gone to an all-new design, both for Ford and Mercury, very linear, crisp kind of designs. But again, kind of handsome. I think Buzz Grissinger was the director, and Al Muir was there, and I can't remember all their various roles, but I know Grissinger was the director. And they were very definite on their wants as far as detail and all of the correctness of the lines and everything, very particular about that. So, you know, as a young designer, well, at least I got a chance to watch this happen and provided sketches and certain amount of design work on tail lamps and some of the details since the cars were really already done.
And this period, the clean, crisp look was...
Yes, yeah, Ford did it. Right, yeah, in 65, Ford introduced a very linear kind of Ford look, and the Mercury probably just a little less so, a little bit more subtlety to the form and everything, but still very linear. Had the big, I guess you'd call them pontoon sides, big panels down each side of the car with little mullions almost, like a woodworking, little, like you'd use a router to put in a little wind split or something down the side of the car. But again, at the time, they were handsome cars and unique, I think you'd say, from anything that General Motors or Chrysler was doing. So everyone had a very strong identity. And from there, I went on to Ford Studio, working on 67 Ford cars. I think we did quite a lot of sketches and full-size tape drawings and renderings and, of course, all the normal grills and taillights. And during this period of time, new vehicles were done every year. We didn't do a 66 and then wait 3 years. We, you know, every year, well, you did basically a new car, nearly all new sheet metal, particularly Ford and Mercury. And unheard of now, but in those days, that was the way you were competitive. Every year you had a new car. And so that, in the studios, it made a very hectic atmosphere. I mean, when I first started, we worked overtime, you know, 5 hours a night, 8 hours on Saturday, and this went on for about 3 years' time, until the middle 60s anyway. Just that was regular. Every Thursday night before a Friday review, you'd be there till midnight, and sometimes 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning or all night or whatever. But it, because of the amount of work and the constant change, why there was a tremendous amount of activity in all the studios.
Can you give us sort of a bird's eye view of the type of activity that you were describing what you've been doing, but can you give us a little idea as to how you were doing it?
Well, it would be a fairly normal design approach where you'd have discussions of, you know, what the objectives were with your manager or whomever, and maybe sketches would be made, or maybe you'd work directly with the modelers on the model with a knife, drawing lines or tape, laying on what you needed to do. And but again, because of the pace, you tended to work rapidly, and at least in my period in the studios, you weren't doing lots of big renderings and spending weeks on one drawing. You basically went very rapidly from idea to full-size model, and sometimes it would be overlays of rendered moldings or whatever that you would be able to hold up and stick on the car, you know, as alternatives. But the way the designer would work would be with working with engineers to determine how large or what section you might have to use in order to be something you can manufacture and be able to assemble on the vehicle, and then work with the modeler to achieve not only those needs, but also to get the appearance that everybody wanted. And of course, Joe Oros was the director of Ford Studio, very strong personality, say the least, and who demanded certainly a high level of activity and certain ways of doing things. And I think Ken Spencer was the exec at that time, and Homer Lagasse, I think, was my manager. I was an assistant at that time. Oh, no, excuse me, this was earlier. This was when I was a trainee still, excuse me. Get our time frame mixed up here. So anyway, during that period of time, again, it was just a taste. 6 months' time, I was rotated on to another studio, special development studio, and this was the first chance I really got to work on a vehicle that was exciting to me personally, because about this time I had purchased a Lotus Elan, which is 1964, was a pretty exotic car for Michigan. I think it was a one, or there might have been one other car in the state, and of course Lotus in those days was almost like a kit car, and but it was an extremely quick and agile little car, four-cylinder Ford-based engine with their own unique dual overhead head on it, and dual Webers, you know, monster carburation. And as I remember, it used to be fun to, away from the stoplights, the Pontiac GTOs were the hot setup in Royal Oak in those days, and you could surprise a lot of fairly decent machinery for the first block and a half, say, then they caught up with you. But it was a quick and exciting little vehicle, and of course I thought that was the only kind of a car anyone ought to own, you know, that was the ultimate vehicle. And anyway, we were doing a little two-passenger sports car proposal, this being a special development studio in advance. I can't remember. Ken Spencer, or some of the guys that might have, Gib Guyberson was the manager, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it ever got to the point where it was a program. It was one of those, we wish we could do it kind of a thing. And I can remember R.J. Miller being brought through. I think he was the president at that time. And, you know, it's sort of a non-event. We all expected him to be really have some reaction to it, and at least as far as I can remember, why it was a non-event. You know, it was like it wasn't there because it wasn't a big regular car, and therefore couldn't be very useful to the Ford Motor Company. That's the way we felt anyway.
Where did the design impetus come from on this one?
Well, it's
fairly radical.
It was, yeah. The little proposal we were working on. I don't think you'd say it wasn't really to be a Corvette, as I remember. It was a very vague kind of a thing in my mind right now. What, other than the fact that it was a small two-passenger sports car, and we've tried those over the years, time after time. But it wasn't really a big V8, extremely high-powered kind of a vehicle, as I remember. But we had done a very low front end with hidden headlights that, you know, popped up, and, you know, all the normal things you could do when you're given kind of a clean sheet of paper. And but the program, is, as I say, it didn't really go anywhere. And so in the 6 months, at least I had a chance to work on some of the programs that I thought were a little closer to what I personally liked. And you don't always get that in a normal production studio, because you have to do whatever the program is at that point in time.
So it never got off the ground?
No. It was one of the many programs that you try, and for various reasons it goes away and doesn't find a real home as far as...
Who would have gotten this started? Something like Gene Bourdain?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it would have been his ultimate direction, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Gene was, of course, the vice president. Yeah, he came in, 61, I guess it was. Of course, I didn't come in until 63, so. Excuse me.
So the special development studio was sort of an advance?
Yeah, this was really his sandbox, I guess. I don't know. He was able to have a more free reign. I believe Don Kopka was one of the execs in there, too, as I remember. I think this was where he... Because they hired several, Homer Lagasse, and several of the guys came over from Chrysler about that time, Cliff Voss, and... Don was in that area, although he had charge of a different group, and Ken Spencer had the group I was in, as I remember.
I guess Engel had left and taken over.
Yes, yeah, he was already gone when I was there, yeah. So, yeah, Gene was able to do quite a number of things. This was the same, not the same area, but at a different time. Of course, they did all the bodies for the GT40, and they did all this development work. Homer and some of the guys worked on those things. Mm-hmm. I had moved on to other studios, but there was a little more open-ended discretionary area that Gene could play with, where today we're probably a little more logical and follow through a little more carefully on the financial end.
But this was a period of time that you enjoyed.
Oh, yes, yeah, a very exciting time in the automobile industry, early 60s, and even up through the time that Knudsen was with the company. Again, you know, very much product-oriented, and from the designer's point of view, he was quite an exciting, at least the things he seemed to support were exciting to us. You know, the actual situation at the time wasn't always so comfortable, but some of the dawn patrols, as we used to call them, you know, people out in the courtyard looking at models at 6 o'clock in the morning when the fog hadn't even lifted and it was too dark to see, but they were there anyway. Anyway.
At this point in the mid-60s, if I may
interrupt,
how does someone like Iacocca impact on the design decisions at this point?
Well, of course, he had been the probably the strong leader, you know, doing the Mustang and at least supporting the things that Gene and Joe Oros and Gail Halderman, the guys that did the Mustang, of course, they had his support on the car, which is very important. And but they were all, you know, they saw, you know, Iacocca and I think Knudsen, even though he had other problems that he wasn't able to overcome in the company, he was very much interested in a product that excited the potential buyer and always seemed to support generally the kinds of things that designers like to have. And some of the best, in my view, some of the best cars that we produced up until recently were really done in the time frame that came out in 1972, so they would have been done in about 68, about that period when Knudsen was here. And that's just one of those things that might not be attributable to him as much as just the time, but in many ways the support came at the right time. We got a 72 Mustang that was, I mean, we had a fastback that out-fastbacked everybody. I mean, the thing was absolutely horizontal, and it became quite an exciting vehicle, even though it became almost too large by the time it hit the road, and we hit all the oil problems in 73 and on that, why it became the wrong thing. But at the time, it was, you know, we were really moving in the right direction, and all the Torino and the Montego and various cars that were done during that era were pretty clean and had a real dramatic silhouette and really held up pretty well in the long term. The Mark IV was done during that period. Excellent, elegant, clean. The Thunderbird of that era, you know, both of the cars sold very well.
But at this point in time, we've got you in the working on the XR7 coming.
Yeah, now that became kind of fun also. Now I'd been in the special development, and we worked on the little sports car, and that kind of fired me up. And then we went back to interiors, and ended up working on what became the XR7, the Cougar. And we tried very hard. Dave Ash, as I remember, was the director maybe at that time, or maybe the exec. I kind of get these things confused without going back through a history. But the idea was to look at the English sports cars. And, of course, having the Lotus and, you know, being all excited about Jaguars and things, well, that was that tied in very nicely to my mindset at the time. And so we, you know, we looked very hard at all the ways the Smiths instruments were treated with the bezels and how the lettering and the graphics were all done. And we didn't, it wasn't that we were really trying to copy them, and we couldn't anyway by the way they're manufactured, but the idea of the the character of a vehicle, the Jaguar, for instance. And so, to some extent, I think the XR7, the 1967 version, had that feeling. And very, you know, I remember 68, I think that was my first lease car, and I ordered the Dan Gurney Special, which had the fog lights, and it had the leather console, and it had a special wooden shift knob, and I mean, it had all the little extra treatments. It had a roof console, sunroof, one of the first ones, and it was quite an excellent car. I mean, and the exterior, that was done, I think, again, with Grissinger, and I believe John Aiken was really the design manager that was responsible for that one. Very elegant, yet highly had its own character. You know, it didn't look like any other vehicle that anyone else was building. And very handsome car. A lot of subtlety in it. A lot of subtlety in the form. And you see, the interior, of course, was the interior people. Still today, I think you find people collecting those particular vehicles.
I had a lease car that year too, and I was fascinated.
It was quite a change from the things that had been available up until then, which were still kind of two-door sedans. Even, in my view, the Mustang, when it first came out, still had too much of the old Falcon heritage. You know, I mean, it was a little bit too obvious in the interior. My first car, when I came here, I bought a 63 Falcon Sprint with a V8. And that car, I ended up selling it to my younger brother, and the car ended up with 130,000 miles on it, and it was still a good car. It was very excellent vehicles, quality and all that we were building during that period.
One thing that fascinates me about working with interiors as opposed to working with exteriors is that obviously you're working in an environment that that the driver spends 90% of his time in.
So well,
it must be very exciting in that sense that you're...
Well, you really, as a designer, you always... you try to go through a very analytical approach in the early stages where you're trying to understand, what kind of a vehicle are you trying to build, who you're going to sell it to, and, why you're going to make certain choices. Once you get that somewhat straightened in your mind, then you obviously got to be able to drive the car comfortably. Everything has to be within reach. We get into what we now call ergonomic, the science of ergonomics, and which is really just making things comfortable for someone to use. And you don't have to unbuckle your seatbelt to reach it and things like that. Very obvious, but still things that get looked over sometimes. But it's very satisfying from a design point of view because rather than being totally a fashion kind of thing, I mean, there are some real strong reasons that you would want to place certain controls where they be most readily available and the organization of the panel. Things should be legible. So it gives you a certain satisfaction, I think, from that point of view. Then, obviously, you want it to be handsome, and you want the materials to be appropriate to the type of vehicle and price class and all that. So.
Well-lighted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They,
I recall that the first one that gave me the kind of a cockpit, which I always found fascinating. The first one that I had experience with.
And yet it wasn't like the Thunderbird, which had the really strong console running down between and the very separated front compartments. And Art Querfeld will be able to talk. He can tell you all about those because he really was involved with that. But those, of course, were kind of a in my view, kind of a no-cost. You could just spend about what you needed in order to make it special. The XR7 wasn't totally unlimited because it wasn't it wasn't an upscale car, not to the extent of the Thunderbird, so we had some constraints in that we had to meet certain underbody and cowl and all commonality with the Mustang at the time. But it did have unique, all the visible pieces in the interior, of course, were unique. But it, I thought the XR7, I was very excited about working on that vehicle at that time.
Still very, very much among aficionados.
I think it's maybe not a classic, but certainly a special interest kind of vehicle, the 67. Yeah, certainly a milestone kind of vehicle in my view. From there, really, I had an opportunity then to go to Cologne, Germany, and work at our Ford of Germany office. This was just prior to the organization being set up as Ford of Europe, with a central hierarchy, and then. Actually, they still have two design offices, but at this time you had Ford of England and you had Ford of Europe, so there was a certain amount of inefficiency, I suppose, in that. But there were certain elements to that. But I was in Germany, which I loved. That was a great assignment. Spent just about a year there, and the work, of course, was really not that much different than I was used to doing in Dearborn. And I was assigned again in interiors. And worked on a 20M Taunus, I can't remember now, but at that time they called their cars in Germany, they were called the Taunus line, and they had various levels, and the top of the line was a 20M, I believe. And who was there? Let's see, Wes Dahlberg, I think, was the director at that time, and then Bob Whelan came over as an exec, and I think Jim Sippel. I've kind of forgotten the sequence. Maybe Jim was there first, and then Bob, one or the other. So I wasn't totally thrown into a foreign element that I couldn't understand the language or anything, because most work around the office was all done in English. And even though I did study German while I was there, as soon as I would try to speak, everyone that I would meet, they would immediately launch into English, because they could speak English fine and I couldn't speak German for anything. So that I never was able to learn very much of it.
The clone plant still
yes.
operating there?
Yes. And at this time, we were in, I don't know if we were in Meerkenich or not. We were right next to the plant. We were on the west side of the Rhine. They've since moved to their new facility, of course, on the other side of the Rhine, and they have a much more modern, more up-to-date facility.
That original plant was...
This was
dedicated by Conrad Adenauer.
Right, yeah, this...
The burgomaster.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah, yeah. This had been a mainstay of the Cologne community for years and years. Built Model A's and mm-hmm. the whole thing there. So, no, Ford was, as far as I know, very well liked, and I seemed to fit in, and I thought it was a great experience. And the design work, a little different approach than we had in Dearborn. A little bit of the, a little less of the hectic work all night. Change everything tomorrow approach, a little more systematic, planned out approach, largely because they had fewer cars and they didn't change them every year, and there were real reasons for it, but it was a nice change for me, a little different look at how people might operate. And
interiors, philosophy of interior design different in Germany?
Oh yes, even then it was a much more functional mm-hmm. approach. Even then their market was more inclined to, but I think to a large extent, in my view anyway, the car represented a sizable portion of a person's income, more so even in the U.S., and people tended to take care of their cars longer, whether it was a social thing or whether it was just a necessity, I'm not sure, but that was the kind of the way the public approached it, so they tended to be a little more serious about their vehicles, as they are today. And again, the Autobahns demand that sort of intensity. You don't get on and just sort of go to sleep at the wheel. You have to get on with it. And so their cars reflect that. And even then, our cars did to some extent, although I think they were more Americanized, if you will, than they are currently, current offerings.
The Taunus was the workhorse of the German Ford.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the ones I was working on at the time, it was a larger one, and they were doing a new instrument panel, and they had a reason they wanted to put a console in the car. And I'm not so certain that it ended up being a great success in the marketplace, but at the time that was the desire, and they wanted to have some gauges so that when you bought this top-of-the-line car with a floor shift and the larger engine or whatever it was, why... they'd have a place to have some additional gauges other than the cluster, which had to be common with their other car lines. So we ended up, I did a design, and it was modeled, and, that went into production pretty much. But so for the period I was there, it was informative, and, of course, I had a chance to travel around the continent and went over and visited Bob Thomas, who was an exec over in England, and saw he and Natalie over at their place and had a great time, of course. And Steve Scherer went over at the same time, and we were probably the first two designers that had been sent over at kind of a working level. I mean, they normally had the executives were Americans over there at that time, but the working level interchange really hadn't taken place to any extent. And I think no one ever told me, but I always thought we were sort of an experiment to see if that would... how that worked, because we ended up living in a hotel the whole time we were there, which got to be a little, tiresome, I guess you'd say. But it was, later on, they ended up, I think, renting people apartments and things like that.
Family come with you?
Well, I wasn't married, so it was easy.
So you were one of the advanced guard?
Yeah, I guess right after that, they did send quite a number of people during the 67-8 period, and... I think everyone would say it was a valuable experience, whether they totally enjoyed it or not. But I enjoyed it. Then when I came back to Dearborn, they put me in interiors. I'm not sure, wasn't sure what I should be working on. I think it was one of those deals. Oh, he's back, and what are we going to do with him? But
who were you working for at that time?
Well, it was sort of a nebulous thing. That was the other thing. Gail Halderman, as I remember, was the exec, and they sort of didn't have a manager, which was great with me. I mean, I just reported directly to Gail, and he said, you know, run your own shop, and, you know, you just do what needs to be done. And so they put me on this special project, and I can't remember that it had a name. It probably did, some code name, but I don't remember right now what it was. But it ended up being the Maverick, and it was kind of a European approach to an interior in that it was a very low-priced car. That was the whole impetus on the program. And so we ended up having no glove box and having kind of a package tray underneath the panel, which is typical of some of the European cars of that time, particularly British cars. And they had a fellow came over, I can't remember his first name, King, Maury King, I think it was, Morris King. I guess he was a manager from Fort of Britain. And he came over and at some point during this time frame, and I can't quite fit it together quickly, but anyway, I was working on this project, and then he was there for a while, kind of as the manager. But I was really doing what was being done. And it was one of those things where I just designed it, and we modeled it, and, you know, there it is. And there weren't really a lot of alternatives. It was just kind of done because it was a very low-key, you know, one staff kind of a guy situation. There wasn't a huge operation working on it. And the interiors, I remember, I actually designed, and we built it up and put it in a package buck. And, you know, that was the way it was done. It really wasn't a great elaborate event.
Can you explain that process?
Well, in order to work out an interior way, they do what you call a package buck, which is really a large wooden box, if you will, but the inside has all the correct dimensions, and the environment is made to represent the interior of the automobile. It has openings for all the windows and all that. And sometimes now we're a little more elaborate with what we do on the exterior, but basically all you're interested is the interior environment. And it has doors that open and, you know, all the normal things, controls located properly. But quite often, you just do a, when they have a package buck, they just do the seats, and they do them with smooth vinyl, and they're correctly located, and they meet all the requirements of the location in the car, but there's no attempt to make them beautiful or give them any design. But as I remember, we did it, we just installed our designs in the package buck. That's what I remember anyway. And it ended up working well because it made the package buck more of an appearance design environment, gave you a little more accurate view of it. And I think it probably helped sell the program at that time, you know, to have something a little more descriptive than just a bare bones kind of interior setup.
Do you have a derivation for the term buck?
Well, I don't know, you might call it an environmental buck. A buck tends to represent like an armature or something, I guess. You know, an armature, though, in our slang, I guess you'd say, would be normally thought of as something that goes underneath a clay model, where you build up a certain amount of structure to stabilize a frame and then have foam, or in early days, where we used to use wood, and then you'd add 3 or 4 inches of clay on top, so you don't have a solid clay model. And a buck tends to be thought of as something you can get in and out of, and representing a car, but not having all the functional pieces of a vehicle.
So this is your experimental design environment?
Right. And it wasn't unusual, I mean, that technique was used, I don't think, but it was, to me, you know, having pretty much my own run of what we did, why it was kind of an exciting period of time, and worked very hard on it and seemed to go well enough. So anyway, I was transferred, I think I was promoted to a senior designer probably about then, and transferred to Ford Exterior.
Before that, did the Maverick interior go as you designed?
As I remember, various other people got involved afterward and actually, you know, did all the final release and, of course, all the final approvals and everything. This was a very early preliminary stage that I was involved. But the panel pretty much stayed, and, you know, good or bad, but it was... It had no glove box initially, and again, as so often happens, in the initial stages, our objective was to be absolute low cost, minimum weight, minimum cost, all those things. By the time the car hit the road, the time frame was such that they were starting to add things on and try to make it a little more luxurious. And during the early 70s, when the car was still being built, they were trying everything to make it a more upmarket kind of a thing. So quite often you get caught in that. I think they ended up adding a glove box.
Did they?
As I remember, they ended up, because we struggled always to make this package tray beneath the yeah. panel. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, some of the cars do that, and that's fine. That's acceptable. At that time frame, they did it anyway. Here, people couldn't quite understand that. You know, don't worry about whether you can get anything in that glove box. I just expect to have one. You know, that was kind of the right. Well, and that's true. Yeah, you want someplace you can put a few things in and lock it and have some security. So that was always a bit of a problem all during its early time. So I was never sure that it was a great design triumph, really, but it it met our objectives at the time, and unfortunately I think they changed a little bit as the car went along, but it's always hard to go back and redo something when that happens. But the car, the exterior, when I moved in into Ford exterior, it was still underway, naturally, because the car hadn't been approved. This was very early. And this was, by the way, Hal Spurlick was the car line manager on this project. And I wasn't very close to him, but we worked on a somewhat working level basis. I mean, it wasn't a total, and he's still a very intense individual then, and, you know, very...
very creative.
Oh, very much, and hardworking, and, you know, all the things that people know about him. Mm-hmm. But he tended to be the one who would come in with, you know, new ideas every day, and tend to go on that way, as we found out later, you know. But when we went into exterior then, I wasn't really, I guess we did one, Ken Spencer was doing a clay model of the Maverick. In those days, we always did competition. You know, every car line that came up,
Was that a standard procedure,
Gene would ask all of his directors to work on it, or at least most of them. And I can't remember during those early times when we'd just do one model of anything. It was always, maybe each studio did one, but quite often even your own studio would do a couple. And then the other studio would do tours. You know, there was always more choices. So anyway, Keith Teeter, I believe, was the other exec, and I think Ken Spencer was whom I was working for. And I believe Keith's car was one that was picked. And it had, of course, pieces of a car that Dave Ash had done and this and that. Typical, we'd take all these cars out to the courtyard, and you might have, you know, a dozen clay models out there. And then the design committee, Henry Ford and whoever else would be involved, they would come through and pick various elements quite often. Very rare that you'd get a total car picked and just walk away with it. Usually you'd pick up a rear end from somebody and this and that. And then they'd have to. So then you'd go from that meeting and you'd go back and remodel whoever it was that got the assignment then, whichever studio. And quite often you would even continue competing after that. Everybody would go back and put these elements together, plus whatever else they could do. And so it wasn't always a clear decision.
Fascinating process. Can I take you back to that design committee review?
Yeah.
If you could sort of detail exactly how that worked.
Well, I think it's still similar kind of reviews, but the process was a little different in that in those times we had so many alternatives offer up, number one. Which a lot of good things to be said for that. We're not able to do that currently, really. But they were done quickly, and so in one sense, I'd say they weren't invalid, but they were done so rapidly, and you know, there wasn't that much planning and careful thought went into everything. I mean, you did something every week, and you gave your best shot, and then you went out and competed. But there was tremendous competition among the studios, and I mean, it was serious. You know, to win one of those programs was very important to your career, certainly for the directors and execs and all. And so that was why the tremendous effort that was put forth. I mean, the demands were just amazing. In a very short period of time, well, you'd be expected to put whole models together. And so the modeling and design forces were large, and they worked very hard. But the design committee... I'm sure, you know, it would be, since I wasn't involved, it's hard to list off who it would have been during those period of time, but it would be obviously the president and the chairman of the board, because Mr. Ford was very personally involved all during this period of time. And so those selections, you know, those major decisions were, of course, made by those people.
The board and A would bring in...
Oh, yeah, yeah. He, of course, Gene would... Right, and he'd present all of his models.
Would he name
models.
The designers?
Well,
would Henry Ford know, say that you had a particular...
Oh, not at my level, of course, but he would certainly know the directors.
Director,
oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 They'd be out there very likely presenting, and, oh, yeah, you know, Joe and Dave Ash and who else would have been out there?
Joe
Oros. Yeah. You know, they'd be out there frantic in the morning of the show, you know, do this, do that, you know, and everybody would be just scrambling, you know. It was a very high energy level.
It must be very exciting.
Oh, yeah. It's more so now to look back on it, but at the time you had to say it was exciting. It was just, it was sometimes more than frantic, yeah.
I mentioned the fact that if HF2 would see a device he liked, who would be making the, who would be marking down the decisions?
I'm not sure I'd know the name. I don't know, Burmeister or whatever the person might have been at that time, but it would be the secretary of the committee. And, of course, it might have been, I'm trying to think, the fellow that used to work for George Haviland, used to work for William Clay in the building, someone, either he or someone like him would be putting together what had happened. And, of course, Gene would be offering up his alternatives. I don't know. I always had the opinion that he and Henry Ford got along well, or he understood what Henry wanted, and so I don't know how strongly he would recommend certain things as much as just he knew what to do and would offer them up and kind of allow them to make the selection and whatever. He had out there, basically, I think he felt was a good solution, and he didn't, I don't think the technique at that time, at least my impression was always that you didn't go in and hard sell it, you just allowed them to make their selection.
Did that process work fairly well?
Well, I guess you'd say it did, based on, you know, our relative success during that period of time. And from a designer point of view, it seems a bit untidy, quite honestly.
Yeah.
You know, that isn't the way I would try to go about business. But I don't know. You can hardly say it was totally wrong. We made money and we built some good cars, and it's just a little more creative, I guess you'd say. The only trouble is sometimes we would end up with cars that people always say, well, you end up with a camel. You know, if you have a committee design it, then design a horse. So.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the cars, as a designer, we would lament the fact that you lost certain subtleties and finesse and all that. To the buyers, I don't suppose it mattered because the quality didn't change. It was as good as it could be anyway, and some little subtlety of line was mostly for us, I'm afraid. That's usually the case. But I can remember the 67 Thunderbird and certain others were... You know, one director got the front end and somebody else got the rear end, and, you know, we always used to laugh and say, look, you know, they don't even fit, you know, look at that thing. And, you know, there it went. You didn't question it. If it was approved, boy, you didn't touch it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Gene would make sure that you didn't move a thing once it was approved, no matter what. And unless there was some terrible engineering disaster. But basically, you know, unless they forced you into adjusting something, why, it went the way it was approved.
As far as the approval process goes at this point, you've got something approved and you're going to cobble it together. Then where do you go from there?
Well, at the point then you have a theme approval, I think you'd probably term it. You have some feasibility, you know, maybe not total, but people have been through it enough that they understand where you are, and you met what we call hard points. You know, we're basically clearing the engine and we know we can open the doors and be at a proper amount of room inside and all that. So from then, drawings, well, in those days, we didn't have our electronic scanners. We had our craftsmen in the wood shop who would cut templates. And they would come in and work, I don't know, all night or whatever, but they would work tremendous overtime hours, just unbelievable. And they would actually cut cardboard templates very accurately, sanding and, you know, stapling pieces together, and ended up with templates every 5 inches and more so if you needed more information. And then those would be taken and transferred onto drawings by our studio engineers, draftsmen. And then those drawings were, copies were made and sent to engineering, body engineering, engine, you know, whoever needed information, basically body engineering we'd be working with. And as adjustments had to be made, then you would feed information back through that process. Then, of course, the release to make die models, the drawing that we sent over to Bot Engineering would be then what their surface layout people, I think at that time we actually had them in the design center, and they would make the final drafts, and I think at that time they would do it on what they call plates, which are great sheets of aluminum that have kind of a chalk, I guess, on them, you know, coating, and they would actually scribe this in, and that became the final Bible. That was it.
Uh-huh.
And so all of their, it was more dimensionally correct, and paper didn't vary and all that as much, and so they used that for all their die models and tooling and everything. And, you know, I can remember people, you know, when cars were proven, and later on you'd see the production of it, and you'd say, gee, I don't remember that, and, you know, various things kind of crept into it. Of course, the people that were actually involved probably, they knew they had to make compromises. So that still goes on, but we're probably a little more disciplined in our approach for various productivity reasons. But a very exciting and productive time, just because of the constant every year turnover of new models, revisions, new front ends. I mean, cars, well, year after year, if you look back through late 50s, well, all the way from the early 50s, every year you basically did a new car. And we did that all the way into the 70s almost. So that it was a tremendous amount of effort put forth in this city during that period of time. during the time I was in the Ford studio, then also I was senior designer, which is essentially assistant manager, and Homer Lagasse was the manager. And of course we had Homer Lagasse, Ken Spencer, and Joe Oros. And you talk about a group of personalities to work for. I was never right. There was nothing I could do to be right. I'd always do it at least three times, whatever I could do. Because no matter what one of them would think of, the other two would want it exactly different. And it wasn't they couldn't work together so much, it's just that they were all very strong personalities and very competitive, and it left on their own, they'd do it their own way. You know, and if Joe, of course, forced, you know, this is the way I want it, which is eventually the way we always did it anyway.
He was
a director.
Yeah.
And he was a very strong driver as far as wanting things exactly the way he wanted it, and had a very, you know, he had a lot of little mannerisms in the studio that were great fun for people to mimic and all that behind his back. But so there was a certain amount of fun that went on, I guess, that
some
way. But
friction.
Well, it was just a lot of conflict of personal approaches to design, I guess you'd say. But we were working on 69 Mustang, and that was a pretty radical vehicle. That was the start of we ended up with some really large engines in the car. I remember having a 69 Cobra Jet with a 428 in it. That's when we did the shaker hood scoop. I can remember Don Fry at that time with the company and came in with us. He was in charge of engine development or something, I don't know, whatever. And he came in with us shaker hood scoop, and we couldn't believe it. The designer said, this thing's going to stick through the hood. I mean, it looked like a hot rod kind of a thing. And maybe I was just a little too, I was a little more of the European design persuasion as far as automobiles. And about this time I had purchased I bought it actually in 65 before I went to Europe. I bought a 911 Porsche when they first came out. And so that was sort of my ideal, those kind of cars. And, you know, a Mustang, yeah, fine, I can understand. But come on, guys, this is a little bit funny. But we managed to do what we thought was our best job. And, of course, Joe, he wanted it. Joe was not one to be subtle. He liked things very obvious, and at least in my view, he was not one to worry over the subtleties. If an inch would do it, why, two's got to be better, you know. I mean, to really make it bold and strong. So I think the 69 Mustang kind of typifies that, because the 65 was kind of lean and trim, 66, not much change, 67. A little sweeter, a little more fullness. And by 69, we're talking heavy-duty forms. This was, you know, very dramatic kind of things.
What was some criticism among the design?
Well, I guess, you know, I don't remember any great, other than just the struggle of how do you do these headlights. Here we had this tremendous plan view on the front end, you know, swept away with a big V in the center. And how do you get the headlights into the grill? And I can remember working with the modelers trying to get these headlight bezels, which are now on two planes. They have a plan view, and then you look at the side of the grill, and it's leaning this way. So you have two planes you're trying to work with, and still in the front view, you have to have a round headlight. And that kind of thing is something you can't say, well, just go draw it up, and we'll make it. You know, you end up having to work with a guy and model it and walk around the car and make sure it looks right in all views and make sure Joe's happy and, you know, on and on. And that sort of thing really, those are the things I remember anyway. And, of course, about then, the federal requirements first started to roll in, and the first thing we had to do was put side markers on the cars. And I can remember, you know, late evenings, frantic running around trying to, you know, everybody again, all the studios start competing. Well, they wanted to end up the company because they had to do it in a short time frame. They wanted one that they could use on several cars. And so we ended up doing this little rectangular bezel with a little chrome bezel, and it had to have a little black line in it. And I mean, it was a trivial sort of thing in a way, and yet it wasn't easy to achieve. You know, it had to be fussed over quite a lot. But eventually we were able to put the side markers on, and we met the requirement for that year. And of course, from then on, things got more complicated.
But these are the illuminations.
It was decided that if you pull out of a driveway or something at night and you don't see the side of the headlamps, which you normally wouldn't, there's no way to know you kind of have a car in front of you, so little marker lights would be appropriate. In Europe, I think probably even then they require one kind of mid front fender or something. They didn't want one front and rear, but our requirements were front and rear.
It worked out very well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And now, of course, we incorporated into the other lamps, side lamps or the parking lights or something. So, you know, as you work on these kinds of things, you find that you can adapt to quite a number of requirements if you know about them and you have a chance to work with them. But the first efforts on some of those things were a little bit difficult. Bumpers we'll get into, but those were something else. I worked there until about May of 1968. All of my assignments up until then had been seemingly about 6 months or a year in any one spot. And at that time I was promoted to design manager, and I moved to interiors, and I had charge of the Ford car and Thunderbird interior studio.
This time, has Knudsen come in yet?
Yes, I think so. I'd have to look at something, but I think it's about that time that he came in. Sometime it was in 67 or 8, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, he was there even in 67, I think.
67, yeah.
Yeah, because that was when I was in Ford Studio, and we had these early dawn patrols, they called, and because Keith Teeter and some of the execs would have to be out there with their models. And I mean,
can you give us a sort of a picture of what changes Knudsen's habits?
Well,
how it impacted on the other design executives?
Yeah, you know, of course, anytime you bring in a new authority person, why certain changes. You know, he has certain styles or management techniques or whatever. But here, you know, he came over and really by himself, in a company sense, he really didn't bring over a lot of other top executives. Other than Shinoda, of course, but Larry was in the design end of it. I mean, I'm thinking more in his corporate structure. So he really hadn't any allies other than, you know. So I think, you know, he's just a very strong personality, I gather. I don't know the man at all, but very strong ideas on what he wanted. And so immediately, the Thunderbird at that time still had kind of a what we called a rubber band front end. Had a little kind of a didn't have too much plan view. It had kind of a mouth or a jet plane mouth or whatever you'd want to call it in the front, I guess, to describe it, but kind of a rectilinear thing. And right away he wanted to put a peak, what we called, ended up calling the Knudsen nose. I mean, he wanted to put a peak on everything. I mean, I think the Ford cars, they put it on a little center peak in the thing. And so that was his little signature to do something to these cars that really had already been started. I mean, they were already pretty well along. And so, in some cases, anyway. So there was a great crash to get these little signatures on these cars to make it his car. And then, as he got into some of the new cars, it was, of course, a little easier to apply whatever things he might want that way. But, he projected a very strong personality, and I think he made, Gene never expressed it too much to me, but he made life very difficult for some of these guys because he made very strong demands, you know, do this, this, and this. He brought in Larry Shinoda under as a lower level, I don't know, executive, I guess he was. And here he's working for Jean Bournet, but really he doesn't answer for anybody except Knudsen. Mm-hmm. And that became very obvious, and Larry, of course, made no bones about it. He enjoyed that kind of thing. And
very painful.
Oh, Bournet. Well, and just difficult, because he would try to follow maybe instructions from Iacocca or someone. I'm sure there's that kind of a conflict going on, and he'd get the phone calls and then try to go do that. And of course, Larry'd have no part of it and go around it, you know, endless kind of stuff. And
was Shinoda good?
Oh, yeah. As a designer, I'd have to say, he's a good designer, very good. Probably better in his own business as he is now, because he is, again, very strong personality. It's his way, and that's the way it is. It's perfect that way, and there aren't any other choices. I mean, that's kind of his approach. But he's quite often right. It's just that design isn't quite that simple. I don't think there's any absolute right and wrong. There's always a wide variety of good choices that you can make on most anything. And in any kind of a corporation, you can take a fairly strong view, I think, of your philosophy, and you try to follow through on that, and you try to sell it and all that. But I think there's a limit to what you can actually force on people. They have to sort of want to go along with it and understand why and all those kinds of things. And Larry wasn't, I don't think he was the one to bother to explain or bring people along. It's just that's it, because that's the way I want it, and, you know, how can you question it kind of thing. So he took a lot of the, I can remember some of the execs that had worked on the 69 Mustang and had these little fake vents in the rear quarter panel behind the door, these funny little things up there. Okay, they're kind of peculiar, and, you know, why would you want to do that? But anyway, there they were. And so in the 70 Mustang, he went, of course, everything he got involved in, you know, it was one of those deals. Everything, boy, the Pinto, the Mustang, everything had to have Larry's input. And of course, the other directors and execs didn't really think that was his point to be doing. He was an executive designer, and he was in charge of advanced design or something. He wasn't in charge of all their areas. But he would go into meetings, and he'd bring in his own proposals or something. He always do these things up as a special, you know, the Boss Mustang. That was his idea. And, you know, very clever, you know, the name and all. I guess it was his idea. I'm not sure that it wasn't. And bright colors, and, you know, I can remember several things that he kind of really, and the little wing on the rear. And, you know, you have to give a guy credit. He would not take no for an answer. I mean, somebody said, well, we can't do that. Well, I'll show you how you can. You know, it was one of those. And so
an awkward time for all of you.
Very difficult, particularly for the guys up in the management, top management roles, because they got information from, I mean, they got instructions from people other than just Larry. But anyway, I remember the story on the Mustang. He said, well, someone asked him, well, why did you take that little vent out of the quarter panel? Because they had to rework it then for 70. It was already way late.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, because it's, you know, it isn't good. It shouldn't be there. I don't like it. I don't know, whatever the words were. And like, you know, any idiot that would ever put something like that on a car shouldn't even. And, of course, this was the guy he was telling that had put it in. So very, very exciting times. Although I really think that we did some of the better cars for quite a number of years. Part of it was because we got into bumpers right after that, big federal requirements, and that kind of, where you weren't able to do an entirely new car, and you had to hang these things on existing vehicles, some of them became a little lacking in finesse. You know, the Mark suffered from that, the Mark IV. In 73, we had to put one on the front, and then later in the rear, and it became kind of strange-looking beast to us, anyway. Excuse me. But, those were pretty intense times. But I was talking about the Don Patrol things, where he would, again, I think it was because Knudsen wanted to impress on everybody, you know, hey, I want you guys here on time, and, you know, we're going to work hard, and, you know, it was all these messages he was trying to send out. And
at some point, it seemed to push everybody back about it. They'd get there at 6:30.
Oh, yeah.
And 6.
Right. Oh, it got almost funny. I mean, it really did, from my viewpoint, because I wasn't in any position to be out in the meetings or anything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they'd be there, like I say, before sunrise, and they already have to have the models out there and be walking around. Well, what can you see? Seriously. But anyway, maybe that's overstating a little bit, but it was almost that bad. And another time, they wanted to take a car out, and it was snowing. And there was already 3 or 4 inches of snow in the courtyard. Well, take it out. You know, I said, take it, you know. So out it went, you know. Very strange, very strange.
Wait, is that the incident where it was white?
Probably, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, that's one of the more famous stories. And I think that probably that Knudsen then and whoever else was looking at it probably rode around it in a van or something. I'm sure they didn't walk out in the snow, but the millwrights and, you know, all the other people, they were out there. So some very amusing now, anyway, things like that. And I wasn't really personally involved, so it's kind of hard to know all the inside stuff on that. But it was an exciting time, and during that period, of course, there was a lot of expansion in the design center. So from a very parochial view, we had some pretty good times, because expansion always means extra jobs and promotions and things like that came along during that period. So some of the things, and I think the designs were really some of our better for quite a period of years, until we were able to get back and really kind of deal with the government requirements with all new vehicles. Once we were able to do that, then we found ways to solve those problems.
In spite of the turmoil, then, this was really a halcyon period for design history.
Really, and also, again, we were, pursuing the Boss Mustang and the racing and all those things were going on. So in that sense, yeah, very exciting and stimulating kind of times for people that are nutty about automobiles anyway. But
did you get involved in the racing?
No, never did. You know, I always missed the assignment where the Mark 4 or 5 or whatever they were building at the time was done. It was always done in Gene's corporate project studio. And quite honestly, there weren't that many people involved. I mean, you can imagine it's one clay and you don't have to go on forever. You don't have to take it through committees. It's basically whenever Gene's happy, well, that was it. So, but it was fun for the people involved and very... but again, a lot of turnover, a lot of quickly, the needs were immediate. You know, they find out a front end doesn't work, we have to have it resolved right away. And so there's a lot of pressure in the shops and the design studios and all. But as you say, very exciting and stimulating times. You know, I can't remember ever not wanting to come into work or having any of those kinds of thoughts. Of course, I guess I haven't any time, really. It's still fun, good business to be in. So... anyway, as a design manager then in interiors, why I really got to do the interior for the 72 Thunderbird, which was quite a step away. It became, at least in my view, it was more one of the first kind of cockpit cars that we were able to do without all the things we'd done in earlier Thunderbirds, where they had the big consoles and lots of bright and die-cast. I mean, now we're into something where we can't afford the weight and the money, and we have to have a little more... usage of passenger car components, so we had to make something where you could still get a passenger in the center, and things weren't quite as extreme as they were on the earlier ones. But
less of a sports car.
Yeah, it was a big car too, but I thought we had very handsome interior. We came up with a nice, simple and elegant seat design, the leather, big padded, I don't know, 2 or 3 horizontal pleats, and they were, I think they had one button in each, kind of elegant men's club look, and the instrument panel had good ergonomics. Everything was able to be reached from the seat, and I thought at the time, it was a fairly good job. Again, a lot of the things were, selected from sketches that my designers had done, and anyway, as a young design manager, it was satisfying to do something that you felt you had done the job fairly well. Also, we did the 71, let's see, what would it have been? Finished up, I guess, the 71 Ford instrument panel when I came in, and then did the 73 or something like that. So not monumental design efforts, but fairly satisfying to me anyway. Then I moved on to Mercury Exterior, and that was where I really first got involved with finding out about this federal bumper requirement. And of course, quite often our company, in most designers' views anyway, we tend to be very conservative when we interpret these requirements. And there's a certain amount of extra built in by various people who want to make sure their part never fails and they're always safe. We always accuse engineers of that. And anyway, we ended up with these monster logs on our car. You know, the car had been approved more or less with nice, if you remember, the 72 Mercury had quite a lot of form to it, and the bumpers were all very flush. We'd gotten to a point where we had almost no bumpers, really. I mean, it was almost silly. But suddenly now, not 3/4 of an inch protection, now we had about 4 inches. And it, almost a vertical section rather than something that tucks under. So these were just a trauma for us to try to work on. I mean, you'd put them on the car, and Ken Spencer, I think, again, was the exec at the time, and, you know, he'd just look at it, and it just either wouldn't say anything to you or just, you know, total disgust. And, you know, it was very difficult because it seemed to be absolutely nothing you could do and meet all the requirements of corner hits. Well, then we find out, of course, that General Motors didn't put the full 5-mile-an-hour requirements on the rear of their cars until about 3 years later. They did it in segments. They started out with the stroke, then the next year they put the pendulum in the front, and then in the corners later, and, you know, they did it. But they had to retool their bumpers every year. And we, of course, took the approach to give we went the full shot. We're doing a new car, and we put it all on. We didn't have to retool our bumpers every year. So I guess we did the right thing, but it was a difficult time to live through.
Satisfied the federal requirement.
Oh yeah, we did our good for the country, I guess. But it was a little hard to get real excited about sedans that were already, you know, a very spacious passenger car and hardly a sports car, and now we hang these great rectilinear things on the front and rear. So eventually, we've learned, you know, now if you see a car with no bumpers, it seems odd. So I guess you learn to live with things like that.
Now you've been abruptly transferred to the exterior. Was that quite a change for you?
Well,
you've done some exterior work.
Yeah, I'd done interior and exterior before, so, you know, personally, no, it wasn't. Other than, you know, certainly the work that you're doing is totally different. But Don Kopka, I think, was the exec in interiors when I was promoted, and then I believe he was promoted to director about that sometime after that. And, you know, at some point, well, I guess they decided to give me a change or whatever. I don't know. Nobody ever told me why exactly, except I'm sure knew that my preference was really to work with exteriors. Although from a design satisfaction, I don't know that you could say one is better than the other. It's just you tend to end up liking one or the other. Most people do a little bit better. But I was happy to try something different and get into an exterior studio. But it was you know, we did a 4-door station wagon. That was the program for the 73 Mercury. So there weren't any sports cars and all that kind of thing. But again, very, you know, the kind of work you'd expect to do.
Prosaic, but satisfying.
Yeah, and I think the car, you know, it turned out to be a reasonably handsome vehicle. It's held up well over the years as a design. It wasn't particularly a fad or anything outlandish that way that quickly went out of style. Don't think anybody would put it in any museums, but there you are, you know. Oh, yeah, I think we did all right. Then I had a chance to move, this is in 72, and moved over to advanced vehicles. And this is one of those areas where really you end up working on whatever Gene decided you ought to be working on. And again, you know, a bit like the old corporate project studio, which, you know, we tend to go through reorganizations from time to time and different titles on things. But I think it was actually a small car advanced vehicle, as I remember, but I kind of forgotten the titles and all. But we ended up working on a Cougar Torino program, which would have been a replacement for the one that was already out. And we did that for a while, and then we did a Mark IV, would have been Mark V, excuse me. And John Aiken, I believe, was my exec then. And we ended up doing it on a smaller wheelbase. We did it on a Torino wheelbase, 114 inches, I remember. And we were happy with the appearance, you know, a very chiseled, very linear, crisp kind of thing, where the Mark IV had been a bit softer and with a single brake in kind of the middle of the car and horizontal plane, but the upper surfaces were very full. We chose more kind of reminiscent, Mark IV was more reminiscent of shapes on the 61 Continental sedan, I think, a little bit more of that section. And the Mark V, we wanted to change. John and I wanted it to be our own car, and so we took a very chiseled, I guess you'd say, approach, although the car had, we tried to put a little plan view, although if you look at them now, as we did recently, we had one in the studio looking at, compared to a Mark 7, And it is amazing. that is a lot of car. But it ended up going on a 120-inch wheelbase. For a time, they thought they'd go on a smaller, lighter, and all that. But we ended up using the carryover platform. And so it became a little bit larger car. And the front end is one of the areas where we probably out-tricked ourselves in a way. We wanted that grill to run behind the bumper. And, of course, now we have the need to have these 5-mile-an-hour bumpers, so I can't just put it on a cosmetic bumper. It has to be a functional one. So it has a certain bulk and travel that it has to move. So we wanted that grill, though, to be continuous rather than stopping at the top of the bumper and then kind of fake it underneath or something. And so we modeled it that way, and we pulled the bumper well forward and made this big space in between and got the grill all down below as low as we could get it and not run into curbs and everything, certain approach angle requirements. And, boy, we thought that was great. But every time I've ever seen one on the road, I've yet to see anything of that grill under there. You know, you just, I guess when you walk up to it, it may be nice if you washed your car or something, but I'm not sure it ever paid off much. But in those days, no one was very worried about the extra weight. Oh, you want to move that front bumper 4 inches? Well, you know, okay, we can put a little more iron into it. And, you know, shortly after that, we became very critical, or concerned, I should say, of fuel economy and weight and all those things. But at that time, we hadn't caught on. We were still able to, if we wanted it to look that way, and of course on a mark, that was the whole reason for being, was to be the best looking vehicle on the road. So we made it as dramatic as we possibly could within the package that we had. And then we also worked on what became the first Versailles.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? That seems to be a fascinating...
Gene had had this idea, you know, I don't know how many years, but he had tried so long to do this kind of European-sized luxury car. And the European Granada, and they tried putting a Mark-type grill on one. And I mean, they did several things. Ghia had done something. And we did... in a year and a half time, we did at least 3 or so, and I expect there were others done in other areas. I think maybe Del Rosa was the director during this period. And, of course, we started out with all new sheet metal, and we did what I would call a handsome 4-door sedan, but smaller and more concise and still very much an American luxury car. It wasn't going to be mistaken for any European car, but... At those times now, this would be in about, 73, late 73 probably, early 73, I've kind of forgotten the time when we were working on it, but the investment was always too high, and versus how many they could project they'd sell and all this, even though it was a high profit margin and all that, but an all-new car is still a lot of money, and what do you take it off of? And, well, you know, different choices. We did three or four different models, different sizes, what you'd take it off of. We had a Granada out there, so we tried to, do it off of the Granada, but with all new sheet metal. Well, couldn't afford it, so all right, let's do one, have an all new front and rear end. Well, even that we couldn't afford. And that poor car, by the time they got down to, I moved out of there, and I didn't end up following up on all the final feasibility things, but what we finally ended up selling was just the front 3 or 4 inches, you know, what we call the grill opening panel, mm-hmm. and the end castings of the fender, and in the rear we had a deck, and the taillights. And the taillights actually just laid on top of the normal sheet metal to get that little change in shape. And the car, you know, they put money into it, superb quality, leather everywhere. You know, people now, I know people that look for them as a used car because of the quality that's in the car. Just tremendous effort to make it quiet and well-built. But it really never made it as a design because it was just a Granada with front and rear end, unfortunately, and you could never hide that. You know, it was just not possible. But
was money getting tight at this time?
Yeah, it was a severe crunch on investment, and I can't remember right now if it was because of anticipated problems or maybe there were already real sales problems. I don't think there were at that time, but they just weren't going to spend that kind of money for a segment. They weren't certain of any tremendous volume. Of course, Gene was absolutely, as I remember, devoted to this kind of a vehicle, but. He'd come back and say, well, we've got to try one more. And he said, you know, you got to do this, this, and this. And we'd cut down the content each time. And
what was the interior reaction, the internal reaction to the final Versailles?
Well, I, you know, from a designer's point of view, I can't think of any of my colleagues who would hold it up as any high mark in automotive design. It was a pretty heavy compromise at best. As I say, the actual vehicle was quite a good vehicle, but from an appearance standpoint, I wasn't happy, and I'm sure Gene wasn't. You know, it was the best we could do with what we could. It was almost, in my view, I would have, you know, if it had been my choice, I probably would have said, well, I guess we just can't do it if we, but, you know, once you get into one of those situations, I guess there may be other pressures that you have to follow through on. I don't know what pressure he was under. Maybe it was just his own absolute, you know, conviction that there was a market for that kind of a vehicle, and, well, if this is all I can get, why, that's what we'll do. But it could have been better if it could have been an all-new car. We finally did get that car when I did the 82 Continental.
Yeah.
There would have been one 2 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. But again, this is during the period of 1978-79, cutbacks in money and appropriations and all. So we weren't able to do it until 82.
Wasn't there pressure from Cadillac at this point that you knew they were bringing out a similar,
well,
a small Cadillac?
Of course, they had brought out the the Seville,
yeah.
What, 79, I guess it was. And actually a very clean, handsome car when you consider it came off of the Chevelle or whatever that, you know, old platform was, but really pretty tidy. And we wanted to have one in that time frame and would have had something very competitive. Again, the same follow-through on the Versailles, but with all new pieces, so you're not, you could hide the platform a little better than we did. But the, in 82, this would have been, I came into luxury. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Shall we go ahead and talk about it? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, okay. It doesn't really matter, but
you've moved out of the Mark V and
yeah. And so then in the October massacre in 1974, this is when you know, Gene had gotten the word that he had to cut, I don't know, 30% or whatever, and so you know, real serious concerns in the company of how long we're going to be afloat, you know, because sales were just dive, you know, they just went absolutely down the summer of 74. And so by October, you know, he was given some task, and I've forgotten how many people we laid off, and I laid off, as a manager, laid off three or four of my people, and then in turn was demoted, and John Aiken, my exec, was demoted, and, you know, so we were kind of running around there very demoralized, but on the other hand, happy to have a job. And
expand on that a bit, the impact on your colleagues?
Well, it was pretty much devastating throughout the company. I mean, it wasn't unique even to the design center, although, of course, we felt like we were... But we were pretty heavily hit, and we were hit first, I think, you'd have to say. Oh, I mean, across the board, I don't know what the percentage was, but it was massive, and so it wasn't something that you sort of did by a little attrition here and there. And it went on in several waves. It didn't, I mean, you know, they laid off and then demoted and then laid off again in the spring of 75. I mean, it took quite a while to finally get down to whatever requirement that Gene was given to have to live with.
That's been very traumatic for him as well.
Oh, yeah. No, these were not good times. They were pretty tough. But amazingly, you know, those of us that were there and, you know, been demoted and everything else, you know, I don't know, God, we worked as harder than we ever had, and late, and again, because some of the programs we were working on were exciting, even though I was a design specialist, an assistant manager, I guess you'd say, we were working on 79 Mustang, and this had been in 75, 6, long in there, and so, you know, it was exciting, and yet, you know, your own personal life was going through some real trauma, but those were exciting times because about that time Jack Telnak had come back over from Europe.
Hi.
And this is the whole time when Bill Burke, who was I guess executive VP or something, yeah, he had come back from Europe.
Right.
And then in turn Jack came back, and so my opinion was that for a period of time that Gene probably didn't know how much power Burke had and various things, so, you know, being very politically astute, well, he didn't make any mistakes for a while. He played it however it needed to be played, and of course gave Jack a studio and whoever he wanted and people and staff and, you know, and so set up a group for Telnak, and basically Jack and his group started working on the new Mustang.
Was this the beginning of the NAD approach?
I guess you'd probably say so, yeah. Yeah, I think Burke had North American, yeah, that's right, yeah, corporate structure and all.
He brought Jack Telnack in as sort of a chief.
Yeah, and I don't know who brought whom or how Jack, you know, but anyway, Jack got the assignment to come as it. Now, Jack had been promoted by then to vice president of Ford of Europe for design, and which was a new position when he, well, no, he took over for Joe Oros. Okay, so, okay, but it hadn't been a position too long. And anyway, he hadn't been over in Europe as that in that position, I think maybe more than a year and a half, just long enough to enjoy it, I think, and have a. But anyway, he came back and with his own design philosophy and having a chance to express it here in North American operations, and then also with a new position as a, I think he was an executive director, and kind of a hands-off, at least from those of us that were on the other competing, if you will, groups. We were working for Del Rosa, who was another executive executive director. And we had the feeling we were getting a little more direction and a few more constraints and whatever, and Jack seemed to be able to take what we thought was more of a designer approach and do it the way you'd like to do it. Well, you know, I think there was real competition with Gene, even though there really, by any hierarchy, there wouldn't be. He was working for him, you know, and everything Jack was doing was his and all that. But it seemed very much a competitive thing, because Gene would come over and work with Del Rosa and in our area, and I wouldn't say they directed everything we did, but basically there was pretty strong input on what we were doing, and it was like he just ignored the other group. And so it was a very interesting period of time from the designer end of it, and we did some good design proposals, John Aiken and myself, and I don't know who the director was in there, Bob Zokas, or I can't remember now. Some of that you just kind of shut out of your mind some of those times. But anyway, the cars, luckily the ones that became the Mustang were the notchback and the fastback that Jack and his group, I think he had Toshi Saito and Fritz Mayhew as managers over there, and they both had good proposals, and I've forgotten which one was which, but anyway, they ended up pretty much, that was a Mustang. And they went into all the design research and everything, and really held up pretty well. And we kept doing more of the traditional, or if you'd call it nostalgic or whatever, but trying to follow through on past Mustang themes, and we tried all kinds of things. And while they really took a new approach, and yet it was still a Mustang. And turned out to be quite a successful vehicle. And so anyway, about this time, this would be in the fall of 76, the thing is finally approved and everything's pretty well set.
You'd worked on some of the earlier proposals in 79.
Yeah, and none of the ones that I worked on, you know, they didn't really choose any of them. Whether they had any effect on the final, I wouldn't say so, really. But they were similar. They weren't all that different. But the ones they actually picked were the ones that Jack did. And so anyway, by the fall, or I guess it was August or September of 76, well, then things had gotten a little better, and I was promoted back to manager and given the small car studio, which had the Mustang and Capri, and so ended up with the cars anyway.
This seemed to be the wave of the future, the small car studio. Right?
Well, that was the new vehicle we had to come up with,
right.
And everything else was kind of, you know, all the Thunderbirds and everything were kind of facelifts and partial new, and you know, they were successful, but they were not the all new clean sheet of paper. Here we had a car finally had front and rear fascias, you know, no bumpers, they were flexible plastic, and a lot of innovation and crisp good look. And you know, even though it was based on a Fairmont platform, and we weren't able to get a fast windshield, and weren't able to lower the car as much and as we would like, but all in all, pretty good car, and it's held up reasonably well even now. And so the Capri really hadn't been done, and I ended up doing that, and the pace car version and the Cobra, and you know, all the later derivations of that.
Was this the Capri had been earlier the German car?
Yes, up until then we had always imported the Capri from Germany, and good vehicles. But about that time, I guess the mark versus the dollar situation got to the point where the car was almost too expensive and we weren't able to get the sales, and so it was seen an opportunity to take the Capri off the Mustang and give a larger volume that you could do more things in for both vehicles.
You really expanded your product mix here, haven't you?
Yeah. See, by now, of course, the Thunderbird and Cougar now are off of a frame, body-on-frame type car, which is really based off of Torino Montego from, Parr's platform. And then we have now a Capri and Mustang. And we had at that time, we had a Pinto and Bobcat, and we had a Fairmont Zephyr. And we were developing also a Granada Monarch off of the Fairmont Zephyr, which I got involved in for a short period of time, and through 77, 78 a little bit. And then I moved over to, in the summer of 79, moved over to luxury design.
But before you get into luxury, this period seems to me to be these small popular cars.
Well, this was, we had gone through a period of time with the Mustang too, where unfortunately that car was done, at the time it was done, they decided that we'd gone too big with the previous Mustang, big V8s, heavy, suddenly fuel economy was important, and we've got to be small. So they made it off the Pinto, with improvements and all, but basically Pinto platform. Well, it was, I can't remember the little buzzword that Iacocca used, but it was fit and finish and some little thing that they used to use, but it was all these little precision fits and finishes and little chamfered moldings and a very jewel-like appearance to the car.
Yeah.
But it kind of lost its macho, kind of clean, something you can go out and work on the engine, make it go quicker and dry, I don't know. The Mustang's always had that kind of a image, even though most people never do that, but it has this kind of spirited, fun to drive and all that. Well, the Mustang, too, never quite pulled that off. It had certain other things that worked, but it became a little luxury car, and that was kind of Iacocca's image of it, I think. I think that was really his view, but it was never too successful. So when Jack started on this Mustang for 79, he took a little more of a European approach, having just come from Europe, and it fit in very nicely with the designers who were, all of us that were working on it, why that very appealing approach to a vehicle of that sort.
Yeah. Was and, the small car studio a part of the downsizing?
Well, we used to, years ago, the car lines were kind of Ford, Mercury, Lincoln, that kind of thing. And during that cutback,